Let's Get Legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We don't really take political sides, of course. We're just trying to analyze things on their face as it relates to the law. And when it comes to immigration law, I like to get SIU Professor Cindy Byes on the line. Professor, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Has immigration and politics always been at a tug and pull, or are things notably even more politicized than they normally are when it comes to immigration?
I think immigration's always been pretty political. You know, there have been different times during history when we've had waves of immigration and different responses to that immigration, but it's always had a political element to it.
Certainly does today. I already lied to you. I texted you that would, my first question would be something different, and I gave you a different one. That's how you're so good, Professor Byes. You pivot whenever I give you whatever I give you. So I will start with this. There has been a lot of discussion, and I want to go through some of what these proposed bills by a bipartisan group or Republicans have been. But a lot of people are shouting right now, well, hey, if there's a crisis at the border, President Joe Biden has the authority right now, if he wants, to sign some sheet of paper and shut down the border. What's your professional opinion on that?
I think it's more complicated than that. There are definitely things that the Biden administration could do. But I don't think that there is currently a power in the executive to completely shut down the border based on an immigration surge. I mean, we saw more restrictions, for example, with a public health emergency during COVID, or if there were like an attack on U.S. soil, that would be a different thing. But just because there's a lot of people coming to the border, there's nothing in the law that would give him the unilateral authority to do that. And to completely shut it down.
So when people say, no, of course he can, are you suggesting that he could write some executive order that would order that, but it would be challenged in the courts, and the courts would likely find that it was unconstitutional?
Yes. Under our Constitution, Congress has the primary authority for immigration policy, and there isn't anything in the Immigration and Nationality Act that would give the president that kind of sweeping authority. In fact, we belong to international treaties like the UN Refugee Convention that say that we do have an obligation to at least hear applications for asylum, even if we don't grant them. There's nothing that says we have to take any particular asylum seeker. But we do have laws in place that require us to at least have a process. And that would be upset. It's also broader than that in the sense that we have a very active border in terms of people crossing legally. You know, Mexico is one of our largest trading partners. We have goods crossing the border every day. And so to shut it down, you really have to examine what does that mean exactly for all those people who are engaged in lawful business across the border, as well as immigration issues.
Barring a national emergency or a health emergency, could the president say, well, no, commerce can still go back and forth, and we will accept legal immigrants that are coming through the legal immigration process, but everyone else stop, nothing else coming across? That you're just saying that is just simply not, at least the way you interpret the law and the courts have interpreted the laws and the power of the executive branch, just not possible.
Yeah, and I'll take you back to a famous case during the Trump administration, which is Trump versus Hawaii, which was from the U.S. Supreme Court. And you may recall that during President Trump's administration, there was a series of what people referred to as travel bans, where he was banning people from particular countries from entering the United States. Ultimately, the court said he does have a lot of authority to do that under the immigration statute, but they did still put limits on the president's ability to ban people from, you know, like to say, okay, all people from country X cannot come to the United States. So there was a related issue there in that matter that went before the Supreme Court. And while there was a lot of power and discretion for the president, it was not complete.
So they allowed him to ban from certain countries, but not necessarily because of a religion. It had to be based in some sort of reasoning behind it.
Yeah, in that particular case, the argument of the government was that there were countries who did not have good vetting processes, so we weren't always sure who they were granting visas to and allowing to get on a plane or, you know, to cross the border to the United States. And so it was a national security argument that, you know, we need to make sure that we've got good procedures in place, whether that's biometrics or other procedures, to make sure we know the identity of the people who are coming. And so where the government had done a review and determined that those procedures were insufficient, the court said that the administration did have the ability to bar people from entering the United States until those procedures were brought up to speed.
Could President Biden, if he had a bunch of statistics showing that in certain cities that have been overrun, I shouldn't have used that word, that have been had a lot of asylum seekers in their cities, and let's say there was violence committed by some of them, there are examples of that. Does that rise to the level of being able to say this is a national security issue?
That's a tough question. You know, you'd almost get into statutes involving, like, domestic terrorism at that point when you're talking about issues of crime and who's committing it and how much. And that goes, I think, well beyond immigration at that point.
Right. Yeah, these are really heady things, right? And you never know exactly what judge will say what when. And I think that's what really makes this such a difficult question. Professor Bies, I'm going to put you on hold here. We got a lot more to get to. I do want to get to your questions, too. Text lines are open right now. Phone lines, too, 312-981-7200. We're doing our best to kind of find out exactly what powers the president does or doesn't have and what Congress can or can't do or what they've chosen not to do, perhaps. We'll do all that after this news break here on 720. Can't wait for that. Cindy Bies here on Let's Get Legal. I'm John Hansen. Cindy Bies is my guest from Southern Illinois University. She's my go-to immigration law person. Cindy, I hope you don't mind that title if I do say so myself.
That's quite all right. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Someone wanted to talk a little bit before we get to the congressional action that wasn't taken, that was proposed, to this idea of what right the states have when it comes to immigration. Most notably, obviously, what's happening in Texas, Operation Lone Star, where Governor Abbott is essentially trying just to stop people from coming into his state with the razor wire barriers. And that case actually ended up in the Supreme Court and has kind of left us in a little bit of a bind constitutionally, I think, Cindy.
Yeah, actually, the states have very little power when it comes to immigration. There's a long line of Supreme Court cases going back, you know, 150, 200 years that say that immigration is really mostly done at the federal level. The Constitution gives Congress the power to do things like make rules for naturalization and that sort of thing. And the court has said because it deals with foreign affairs and politics, that it really should be handled at the national level and not by the states. So there isn't a lot of room for states to act.
But what if someone just ignores the rule? Like the Supreme Court said that the federal government could come through and tear out the barbed wire. I think that was like the specific ruling. I don't know if the federal government has tried to do that, but let's say they did and Texas tried to get in the way. I don't want to go down too much of a rabbit hole, but a bunch of Republican governors are trying to back up what Texas is doing. That could be a precarious situation.
It absolutely could. And it takes us back to the days post Brown v. Board of Education when the federal government was called in to integrate the schools. I mean, that's the kind of federal state standoff, you know, we're potentially talking about. And that is not a good thing for our country.
You're talking about perhaps even federal troops being the one with armed like they were in Little Rock or wherever they were to integrate the schools that, I mean, God willing that we don't have some sort of actual standoff, but that's what we're talking about. The federal government might be sending troops in to do some of this if need be.
I mean, if a state like Texas were to disobey a Supreme Court ruling and disrespect the rule of law in that way, you know, that's what it could take. I also hope we're not there, but that's where we're kind of headed if there's continued resistance to the federal government doing what it needs to do with respect to immigration, with the blessing of the Supreme Court saying, you know, this is the way our constitutional system is supposed to work.
Yeah, that brings us to a scary point. Maybe we shouldn't go down there on a Sunday night, but agree or disagree with the Supreme Court ruling, our kind of fabric of how we are as a country is sort of built on the idea that, like it or lump it, you do what the Supreme Court says.
Yes, we do have a tradition of respecting Supreme Court decisions. Now, of course, if we disagree, we can pass new laws, we can amend our Constitution, but we're not supposed to do it through violence. We're supposed to find peaceful ways to change the way that the system works.
Right. Did you have a chance to kind of see the back and forth and what was proposed in the bipartisan immigration bill that ultimately did not pass the Senate? It probably would have if there was even a hope of a chance of it passing the House. It was pretty much stopped immediately by Speaker Johnson and the former president. Did you happen to read some of the things that were proposed?
Yes, I have some familiarity with it.
And what did you think? I mean, what were maybe some of the things that were in there that you think could have actually made a difference?
I think a lot of it could have made a difference, actually. I mean, one thing they talked about was providing additional funding for hiring more immigration judges, more border agents, more immigration attorneys, and processing the backlog of cases. If we were to do that, we could grant asylum or other immigration relief to those who are entitled to it, who deserve it, and, you know, let them get on with their lives. And then we could also work to, you know, potentially remove the people who don't have a valid claim to be here. And so I think that could help a lot. There were some other things, you know, about enhancing, you know, security at the border, more agents at the border. There were some provisions that I thought were long needed. For example, we have a number of Afghans in the country who have come to the United States since the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan in 2021. They need their situation to be resolved. So there were some other immigration pieces like that, too, that would have been really helpful to some particular populations in the country.
We talked about shutting down the border and how the president unilaterally really can't do that except for a national, you know, security emergency or a health emergency. This bill did kind of include that national emergency authority. Is that what it would take to actually grant the president the power to do that? Congress saying so?
Probably, yes. So if a bill like that were to pass, and my understanding is that the way the bill was written is that if we reached a certain level of people arriving at the border and the numbers became so large that, you know, it was sort of overwhelming, then the president would have the ability to stop the entries for a period of time until they could sort of get the situation under control. There were some unknowns about that. Even if it went into effect, it wasn't clear what was going to happen to all the folks that showed up at the border. The news reports I read suggested that the United States had not negotiated with Mexico to talk about how they were going to turn people back, or, you know, if they were going to stay in Mexico or what they were going to do with all those folks. So I think there were still some unknowns that would have had to be worked out.
The bipartisan bill ultimately wasn't. It did remind me a little bit, although we even got closer to the goal line back in 2013. This is actually right after I had a chance to work in Washington in the Senate. I had nothing to do with this, of course. I was just a lowly speechwriter. But the Gang of Eight was a bipartisan group that a lot of people remember. Four Democrats, four Republicans. A bill got passed that had 70 votes in the U.S. Senate that went through, and Speaker John Boehner, who now says it's one of his biggest, if not the biggest regrets, never brought it to the vote of the U.S. House, which was, of course, controlled by Republicans at the time. Why is it so hard to get these things done, Professor?
It's a very good question. And as a person who is not a politician myself, I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that. You know, I think part of it is it's very complicated. There are lots of different interests going on. That Gang of Eight had focused on some employment provisions. There are many employers in the United States who are looking for workers and would like to have more persons lawfully able to take those jobs. And that was a big focus, I think, for the Gang of Eight that could have benefited our economy had that occurred. We still have lots of young people here who have DACA status, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. We haven't dealt with that either, even though overwhelmingly the surveys show that Americans would like to see those young people be granted the ability to remain lawfully permanently in the United States. because they were brought here not of their own choice, but as children by their parents, and really have grown up as Americans. So there's just, you know, so many different pieces of this, so many different interests at stake, and it really does go to who we are as a society, and who we welcome into our society and who we don't.
I have a couple of specific questions from a texter, Professor Bies. Tell you what, let's take a break now. The 773, you've asked some good ones, and I do want to get the professor's take on it. We'll do that after a quick break as we do the last segment coming up of Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. A couple more minutes left with Professor Cindy Bies from Southern Illinois University. Cindy, you ready to take a couple questions from the listeners about immigration?
Sure.
Okay. Someone, 773, I'm engaging with on the text line with some really good questions, basically arguing that it doesn't matter what legislation is passed by Congress if the executive branch doesn't enforce the laws that are there, which I guess makes some sense. Have you seen glaring omissions by the Biden administrations for laws that are passed that are not being enforced by the president currently?
I really don't see that. And the reason I can say that is because there's a lot of discretion that Congress has given to the president when it comes to immigration. And so there isn't a lot of mandates in the immigration statute. Instead, you know, the president is given quite a bit of discretion to decide how to implement the laws. So when you say, when the charge is that the president is not implementing the law, you have to sort of say, okay, what is the law? What does it say? And oftentimes it's not specific. Every administration sets its own enforcement priorities. You know, Congress has not funded the enforcement of immigration law at the level that it should be funded for decades. And so then the administration is left to make choices about where it puts the resources that it has. And so I think that leads to some under-enforcement. But it's not a question of the executive not enforcing the law. It's more about where their priorities are.
Right. And I think that, like, this is what's hard is because, you know, unless you read the actual laws, the entire thing, and not just maybe bits and pieces, that you're right, there is a lot of discretion, and presidents from both parties have taken advantage of that. I guess that really wasn't a question. That was just a statement. Professor, another text from the 773, and I actually had not really dove into this too deeply, and I appreciate the texter for filling me in. I haven't, and I did find a New York Times article to back this up, the idea of how many migrants entering the United States across the southern border, increasingly more than ever, are from China. And the texter said, well, what about the fact that so many Chinese migrants are coming over here, for young men that are military age? Wouldn't that classify as a national emergency? And Professor Bies, I guess you can answer that more specifically, but I imagine the answer is that on its face does not constitute some sort of emergency. You'd have to show that all of them are trying to infiltrate our system. You kind of get what I'm asking here?
Yeah, I do understand what you're asking. And I think any time we don't know who is coming into the country, it does create a security risk. And so it is important for us to be able to screen people and to know who is coming in, you know, why they're coming, what they're going to do while they're here, that sort of thing. And so I do think there's a risk there. However, to just say because someone is from China, and they're of a particular age or gender that they're, you know, automatically a national emergency level risk, I think that is an overbroad statement.
Right, because even if the president said that for some reason, signed an executive order preventing that, it's going to get challenged in the courts, right? And I imagine administrations don't like to, on surface, sign executive orders and try and take action that they know are just going to be reversed by the courts.
That's generally true. I mean, that's a lot of time and resources that they have to put into defending those executive orders. And so I think most of the time, most administrations are going to try to work within the law that they have and, you know, find the way to do something lawfully with, you know, but still accomplish their policy goals that they want to accomplish. But yeah, I do think that we have people from all over the world. I mean, there are many people from Africa, for example, who come across by boat or and enter into a country in South America and then make their way up across the Mexican border. So they're not just people from Central and South America that are coming across our southern border. It's absolutely true that we've got people from all over the world that are coming across that border as well. And we do need to know who they are.
Someone texted in, there's a world of difference between integration and immigration, which, of course, Professor Bias, you weren't suggesting to try and compare those two. You were simply saying the federal response to a state trying to stand up to the Supreme Court ruling, that would present to be a similar situation where the federal government would have to do something to basically force the states to do something. That was the comparison there, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure I heard you correctly, but yes, what I'm trying to say is that we have a system where the states are given power to do certain things under our constitutional system. The federal government is given power to do other things. Sometimes there's overlapping power, but in the context of immigration, the federal government gets 90% of the power. And if the states are not abiding by what the federal government is doing and what the Supreme Court says the federal government has the power to do, then just being defiant isn't going to help solve the situation and could escalate things. So it would be better for us to use our democratic system to change the laws rather than engage in some kind of show of force.
You answered that perfectly. Very good. Okay, let's go to Rich. Rich got a quick question. Rich, what are you wondering?
Good evening. Professor, could I ask you, has there been a spike during the previous administration as far as illegal immigration?
There are cyclical spikes on a regular basis. So if you follow the news, you may know that the numbers went way down in January. That's typical. In the wintertime, the numbers tend to go down no matter who's in the office. And so we did have large numbers at different points during the Trump administration, and then in response to certain policies, and then later in response to COVID, the numbers went way down. So they fluctuate quite regularly.
Generally speaking, though, are they higher under President Biden? If you don't have the numbers in front of you, I'm not asking you to answer 100%.
They are. They are higher during the Biden administration than they were during the Trump administration. Yes.
Okay. Let's go to Sharon. Sharon's got a point. Sharon, what are you thinking?
Hi. Let me just...
Oh, you still there, Sharon? All right, let's put Sharon there on hold. I think she accidentally muted herself. She was asking, and she talked to Iridian about, you know, the idea of shutting down the border. There is a difference, and I think you've talked about this, Cindy, before, about people that cross illegally versus asylum seekers. I mean, that is a very different system to handle both of those situations, right, Professor?
It is different. A person who presents themselves to an immigration officer and says, I want to seek asylum because I fear persecution in my home country, they are put into a particular process. A person who just is coming here because they want to get a job and not because they're, you know, being persecuted in their home country, that's a very different situation. And without, you know, lawful permission to work, then they would be entering illegally and not be part of the asylum system.
Someone has a really good question, the 847. How easy is it for someone to legally immigrate to the United States? Let's say they don't have a sponsor or they don't have a job that's bringing them there. How long does that process take for someone overseas that just wants to come here?
There isn't a process for that.
Really?
If you don't have a family sponsor or an employer sponsor and you're not a refugee, there's virtually no way that you're coming to the United States.
That's not how it was when things were like the turn of the last century, right?
Correct. We had pretty much open immigration in the early 1900s. We started really cracking down around the time of World War I, and that's when we started to put more restrictions in place. But even then, immigration from the Western Hemisphere continued to be sort of, you know, without any kind of quotas for several more decades.
Right. So basically, when people say, well, everyone should just come here legally, for some people, that literally is not at all possible. Okay, we're out of time, Professor Bias. As always, I appreciate your time. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Yes, thank you for having me. Have a good evening.
For sure. That'll do it for Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association.